Today, we have Anthony who will be speaking on why it doesn't matter if we're at war with Al-Qaeda.
Thanks very much. How close do I have to be to the microphone to be? Okay. Great, well, it's good to be here. And I will try to keep my talk within the prescribed time. I have to confess that as I was planning and writing my talk, I couldn't help switching over constantly to the BBC website to find out what was going on with the latest developments in the extraordinary political situation in this country, to find out the latest statements by all these politicians acting in the national interest, as they repeatedly assured us. And so the danger of not having enough time to prepare, as it is when you don't have enough time to pack when you're going on holiday, is not that you take too little, but that you take too much. So I'll try not to overrun my time and allow plenty of time for questions. But basically, what I want to do in this talk is to challenge what is what remains a very common way of framing the argument about the powers that a state has in confronting a non-state armed group, a terrorist group, or other group based outside its borders. In order to move from the specific, from the general to the specific, the powers that the US has in opposing Al-Qaeda. And it's really striking to me, all these years after 9/11, it still seems like the central point at issue in many people's minds when they talk about this situation is the question of whether or not there's an armed conflict between the US and Al-Qaeda. Is the US at war with Al-Qaeda? And if so, is it a global armed conflict, or is it something that's narrower? So now, hopefully some of you are instinctively drawn to this way of looking at things, otherwise my talk may be something of a daft squib. But anyway, that's the argument that I'm going to take issue with. And one of the striking things is this argument essentially is something that you hear on both sides. That is to say, supporters of the approach that the US has broadly followed since 9/11 tend to say there's a global armed conflict, and therefore, according to the laws of armed conflict or the standards associated with armed conflict, we can detain and target enemy fighters on the other side wherever they're found. Whereas opponents, broadly speaking, the European view, as well as a few brave voices in the US, tend to say, no, nonsense, there cannot possibly be such a thing as a global armed conflict against a non-state group. If there is an armed conflict, it only exists within the narrow territorial space of Afghanistan, or perhaps including some of the border regions of Pakistan, and therefore the authorization to use armed force to detain without trial and to target with lethal force, i.e. kill, only exists in those areas, and outside it you have to follow a law enforcement paradigm. So now an interesting question is where the Obama administration is going to be on all this. And it's sort of, I would say provisionally they're coming down to something quite close to the global armed conflict model, but they haven't quite made up their minds. And there are a few intriguing suggestions that they may eventually end up with something slightly different, and maybe I'll come back to that if I have time. So, as I say, there's quite broad acceptance of the idea that the existence or non-existence of an armed conflict is the key determinant of the level of force that can be used. But in many ways, this seems to me a mistaken and even a sort of somewhat perverse assumption. So I'm going to try and defend the claim in this talk that whether or not there's an armed conflict in this situation is essentially irrelevant to the question of what powers, what rights the United States or any other country in that position would have against an external armed group. And in case this seems like a kind of counterintuitive claim, because we're so used to the notion of armed conflict bringing with it these powers, I'd just like to say, from a common sense view, it seems to me that actually that the claim that the armed conflict does give you these powers, as well as being wrong for reasons I'm going to argue in a minute, also seems quite anomalous. And the reason I think it's anomalous is, we're all familiar with the fact that the threshold for armed conflict in a non-international, that is a non-state versus state armed conflict, is very hard to define. There is some jurisprudence on the question. It's to do with protracted violence between organized groups. But there's a lot of disagreement about where exactly that standard kicks in. There's a lot of disagreement about where the boundaries might be. So you have an inherently vague threshold. And the idea that suddenly, crossing this vague threshold would bring a kind of large increase in the powers that the state has at its disposal. Seems to me something quite peculiar in that as well, you know, from a common sense standpoint. So I think that the idea that the armed conflict threshold is significant is based on a series of misconceptions about how the law works in these cases. And I'm going to talk about, as it were, the kind of, what seems to me, the conceptual structure of the law, the underlying normative framework, rather than the kind of precise black letter rules that are involved. But what we're talking about essentially is what you could call a step change model, right? It's a step change picture where the transition to armed conflict is like that. It brings you a whole set of powers that you didn't have before. And I think the roots of this step change picture, as I call it, lie in the traditional conception of war. That is, war is a distinct legal state that transforms the relations of the two or more states that are involved in it. You move from a state of war between two countries to a state of peace to a state of war, and that involves a step change. And that's invoked by a formal statement, a declaration of war from one state or another. And killing and capturing the enemy's combatants are fundamental incidents of waging war, to use the words that the US Supreme Court used in the Hamdi case. They're sanctioned by longstanding law of war principles, which carve out a permissive space for these actions through the restrictions and limitations that they put on them. In other words, the laws of war define the limits to killing and the forms of treatment that are required for prisoners of war, and thus they carve out this space. You know, when you move into the state of war, which is a kind of against the background picture of an international anarchy between two states of war, this defines the limits of what can be done, and so there's a permissive sense that you can do everything permitted within those, particularly killing and capturing enemy combatants. In the traditional picture, this move from a state of peace to a state of war between two countries doesn't involve this kind of step change approach. But even in the case of interstate war, I think it's now a little bit more complicated. And this change came in the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which modified the conventional picture by substituting the notion of armed conflict for that of war. And armed conflict, as it was developed in the Geneva Conventions, is not a matter of declaration or of recognition. It's actually just the state of facts on the ground. It's the fact that force is being used that brings the armed conflict into being now, rather than, as it were, the existence of a state of war legitimating the use of force. And as to the question of whether the use of force by one state against another is per se legitimate, that's a matter for a separate branch of law known as jus ad bellum, which is enshrined in the UN Charter and in the customary right of self-defense. So it's jus ad bellum that sets the grounds and the limits now for interstate force, either through resolutions of the UN Security Council, which can set specific limits, as we saw in the case of the coalition that would assemble to expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait. The force was authorized only to push Iraq out, but not any further to carry through an armed conflict against Iraq, or through the limits of necessity and proportionality in the case of self-defense. So in that sense, it's always a jus ad bellum question whether the use of force by one state against another is legal. And you wouldn't, strictly speaking, say that the United States is able to target Iraqi combatants in a particular case because there's an armed conflict between two countries. You'd say that the U.S. is legitimate in targeting Iraqi combatants because this is within the scope of the legitimate authority that it enjoys under Security Council resolutions, or perhaps not. Having said that, the traditional normative framework does still work, I think, to define the rights and limits of what each country's armed forces can do in an interstate war, an interstate armed conflict, because international armed conflict is understood as a formal contest between groups of authorized combatants. So there is still this step change aspect of proceedings. You have the combatants' rights, which kick in once the armed conflict is underway. Once the opposing armed forces are engaged, then members of each state's armed forces do enjoy the combatants' privilege of killing or seizing members of the enemy's forces. That's something they could not do outside the framework of an armed conflict without opening themselves to a charge of murder or kidnapping. But all this only applies in the case of an armed conflict between states. And if we're talking about a conflict between a state and a non-state group, I would submit that the situation is very different. And the key difference, from following on from what I said before, is precisely to do with jus ad bellum. Jus ad bellum has no place in non-international armed conflict, because there's no part of international law that forbids a state attacking a non-state group, unless this also involves the violation of another state's territory, and equally there's no part of international law that authorizes or could authorize a non-state group to take up arms against the state. So to look first at the, as it were, the kind of simple case of an insurgent movement within the country's borders, a non-international conflict within the borders of a single state, the authorities can use force against a threat to domestic order, subject only to the restrictions of domestic law and human rights law. And when this confrontation between the state and the insurgent group reaches the threshold of protracted armed conflict, you know, then it does turn into a non-international armed conflict. But it's emphatically not the case that the transition to armed conflict allows the state to use military force. It's rather the reverse. The fact that military force, that the state has been obliged to resort to the continuing, ongoing use of military force, is what brings the armed conflict into being. So the significance of armed conflict in these circumstances is merely that it adds an additional set of international law restrictions onto what each side can do to the other. And these restrictions, as we know, are found in Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. But because the transition to armed conflict does not coincide with any international legal authorization to use force, it doesn't give any new right to either side that it didn't possess already. And indeed, this is made absolutely clear in the text of Common Article 3, which says explicitly that, quote, the application of the preceding provisions shall not affect the legal status of the parties to the conflict. And for the same reason, there's no status of a combatant, authorized combatant, in non-international armed conflicts. So if what I'm saying is right, it follows that there can't be any step change in the powers of the state when the transition to armed conflict takes place. And instead, I think the scope of what the government armed forces can do continues to be set, again, we're talking for the moment within the framework of a single country, continues to be set by domestic law and human rights law, operating alongside the new restrictions that are added by the law of non-international armed conflict. And, of course, human rights law is sufficiently flexible to recognize that different standards must be applied in different situations. So if the ordinary rule of law is disrupted, the public life of the nation is threatened by public emergency, then the government can derogate from some human rights rules, including the right to liberty, but only as far as is strictly necessary. And the right to life, although it's non-derogable, does acquire a different meaning in the face of an insurrection, as the European Convention on Human Rights recognizes. So, you know, there's even a convincing argument that we've heard repeatedly that the traditions of the laws of war can help to give us guidance as to the meaning that human rights concepts should acquire within the context of a situation of armed conflict. And this is the lex specialis doctrine, as it's known technically. So, but the important point is that the background role of human rights standards and the absence of any new, as it were, blanket authorization to target or detain enemy combatants imposes a very different model from the kind of step change model that I described earlier. And I would describe this as a sliding scale model, where the transition to armed conflict is only just one point on the scale. The transition, it occurs at a particular point on the incline, but it doesn't in itself determine the gradient at which the use of force becomes permissible, increasingly so, which is always a response to background conditions rather than a response to any existence or non-existence of an armed conflict. So the idea that departures from the ordinary methods of law enforcement can only be justified on an individual basis according to imperative reasons of security is and remains the prevailing idea. Instead of the status-based rules of engagement that we're familiar with from international armed conflict, where it's the status of the combatant that allows you to target or detain him as a prisoner of war until the end of hostilities, forces in non-international conflict must continue to rely on a threat-based paradigm, which is essentially the paradigm that's enforced before the transition to armed conflict takes place. So the threat-based paradigm exists across the threshold. I'm not saying that the, as it were, soldiers in an internal armed conflict can only open fire on an insurgent if he poses an imminent threat to innocent life, the standards that you'd use if it was a basic law enforcement situation, because the background conditions are different and the right to life operates in a different way. But what I am saying is that the soldier can only open fire if he believes it is strictly necessary to do so for the purpose of quelling the insurrection, and he can't achieve the same aim in a less harmful way. So that there is, in those circumstances, no automatic right to target a fighter on the other side, as there would be in the case of a combatant in an international armed conflict. Similarly, insurgents in a non-international armed conflict can only be detained for as long as is necessary for imperative reasons of security. And this is inherent in the framework of derogation that's attached to the right against arbitrary deprivation of liberty. In other words, in a situation of public emergency, you can derogate from the right to the degree that you don't have to automatically give people a trial. You do acquire, in a state of emergency, the power to detain people without charge, but only as much as is absolutely necessary. You can only derogate to the extent that's strictly necessary, but you can only detain people for as long as strictly necessary. Again, this is very different from the situation in an international armed conflict where there's the automatic right to detain the enemy combatant until the end of hostilities. My argument is that these rights simply make no sense in the context of a non-international armed conflict. Now, in arguing against the notion that there's any status-based right to detention or targeting in non-international armed conflict, I find myself in the uncomfortable position of being in disagreement with the International Committee of the Red Cross, the authorities and guardians of the Geneva Conventions, who recently produced this widely discussed set of guidelines about the notion of direct participation in hostilities. And direct participation in hostilities, for those of you who aren't familiar with this complex and long-running debate, matters because according to the laws of armed conflict, that's when civilians can be targeted. Civilians can only be targeted if and for such time as they take a direct part in hostilities. Now, the argument that I'm putting forward relies on the notion that fighters in a non-international armed conflict remain civilians. They remain technically under the law civilians because there's no status, no different status that they could move to in non-international armed conflict. But the ICRC, in their guidelines, has come up with this idea that fighters in an armed group, even in a non-international armed conflict, could acquire a different status than that of civilian if they are performing what the ICRC calls a continuous combat function. And in fact, this was supposed to be the subject of the originally scheduled talk today. So I don't want to talk about it too much, but I just want to say in passing that I think this is a rather peculiar judgment because it seems to me at odds with what I believe is the kind of underlying structure and normative basis of the law. And I also think it's an unnecessary argument that the ICRC is making here. So I think it seems to me to offend against the fundamental value system of IHL, which is based on the equality of application to both parties in a conflict, since the ICRC's claim that people could lose the status of civilians and become liable to targeting at any time in a non-international armed conflict is not matched by any kind of countervailing right that they would acquire as privileged combatants. In other words, their actions could still remain illegal under domestic law. They don't acquire any entitlement to take part in hostilities, which is the so-called combatants' privilege that exists in international armed conflict, and yet at the same time they're losing the privileges of being a civilian at all times. And I think that this is quite anomalous with the guiding principles of IHL. And secondly, it doesn't really seem to make sense to me because, as I've said, I think that international law only plays a restrictive function in non-international armed conflict, and so I don't see where this kind of positive authority for status-based targeting that the ICRC identifies. I don't really see where it could come from in a way that would override the background system of human rights that seems to me to remain in place when we're talking about a non-international or an internal armed conflict. And finally, I think that the ICRC's position is unnecessary because I think they could achieve a similar result in a different way. This is a complex question. We could go into this more in the discussion if people are interested. But my argument would be that rather than, as it were, restricting the notion of civilian so that some people fall outside the remit of civilian, it would be make more sense to expand the notion of what counts as taking direct part in hostilities, so that it could become a kind of ongoing state, a civilian who fights every night and returns to his farm during the day, the so-called revolving door syndrome. That person could be said to be taking a direct part in hostilities as an ongoing state. They'd remain a civilian, but they'd always be taking part in hostilities until they take a kind of active decision or, you know, make an active acknowledgement of the fact that they're no longer doing that. So I think that way would have been much more effective in preserving the underlying value system of IHL. Anyway, that's a very cursory treatment of a complex subject. But, you know, what behind the ICRC's position is something which seems to me a very marked tendency of discussions of international humanitarian law and the laws of war in recent years, which is, as it were, an analogization of international and non-international armed conflict. It's an attempt to kind of take the normative framework that applies in international armed conflict and apply it across in non-international armed conflict. And from a humanitarian point of view, in a lot of ways, this is very appealing because it, you know, expands the range of protections that would be available in the internal non-international conflict. The treaty law is quite limited, and so having customary law brought over is very appealing. But I think that there are dangers in this approach, and I think this notion of kind of somehow importing the idea of a quasi-combatant into non-international armed conflict is a mistake. So far, I've been talking about a non-international conflict as if it was kind of simply confined within the boundaries of a particular state. But obviously what's distinctive about the kind of counter-terrorist military operations that we're talking about is that they're not taking place inside. They're not internal conflicts. And I think there's a growing consensus that these conflicts, which are, as it were, between a state and a non-state group outside its borders, that they remain non-international armed conflicts, according to the typology of IHL, because they don't pit two states against each other. They pit a state and a non-state group. But if so, they are non-international armed conflicts that apply, that spread across national boundaries. And this is a kind of anomalous concept. And I think a lot of the confusion that's arisen about, like, what's the appropriate way to regulate this sort of situation has stemmed from that fact. So, you know, one of the complications here is that there's a, as it were, a disjunction between the use in bello, the laws regulating the conduct of fighting, and the use ad bellum, which is the justification for going to war. And we can see this if we look at the aftermath of 9/11. The Security Council acknowledged that 9/11 was an armed attack that gave rise to the right of self-defense. But the right of self-defense was only relevant in as much as the military response that the United States wanted to undertake was directed against another territory, another state. So that it was the fact that the military response involved the U.S. going to war against Afghanistan that made the notion of self-defense relevant. If, as it were, the attack from al-Qaeda had come within the boundaries of the United States, no one would be talking about how the U.S. had a right of self-defense against al-Qaeda as a non-state group. So it's, you know, it's that international aspect, but it's the use ad bellum, the right of self-defense, is always operating against another state. And so, you know, the question again is, as it were, once the Taliban regime was overthrown, in a friendly regime installed in Kabul, or a kind of supposedly friendly regime, the conflict ceased to be an international one, and then it became a non-international armed conflict with the United States fighting alongside the Afghan authorities against the Taliban and al-Qaeda insurgent groups within Afghan territory, but U.S. operations wouldn't violate Afghan sovereignty at that point because they were carried out with the consent of the Afghan government. And when we consider military operations against al-Qaeda in other parts of the world, in Somalia, in Yemen, in Pakistan, you know, again, I think there's an aspect of it which is to do with consent of the state. Do these actions, for instance, targeted killings, which have taken place in all these countries, Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan, do they have the consent of the states involved? And if, you know, if they have if they don't have the consent of the state involved, you know, what's the meaning of consent or lack of consent in the case of a failed state that can't control its territory, and what's the level of threat from a non-state group like Al-Qaeda, combined with what unwillingness or inability on the part of the government to control it that would justify the US to act against these countries. But these are all questions about USAID Bellum relating to, you know, possible violations of this country's territory by US forces. And the, you know, I think in all these cases, whether or not there technically is an armed conflict between the US and Al-Qaeda wouldn't be relevant to the question of whether there's a justification for the US to launch an attack against an individual located within these countries. The notional existence of an armed conflict between the US and Al-Qaeda could not in itself justify an attack against an Al-Qaeda terrorist located, say, in Italy, you know, if the Italian government didn't consent to that use of force. You'd have to then look at the rules of interstate relations to see whether that attack was justified. And if the host state did allow the US to use force, say the Yemenis, authorities said that it was okay for the US to target a Yemeni suspect, then the rules of whether there's non-conflict or not non-conflict seem to be irrelevant when considering the right of the US to do that. So then the last question to ask is what protection then the individual terrorist suspect has against being seized and detained or being killed by a predator drone at the hands of the US or of any other comparable state. And so I've already said that in a domestic context, it seems to me that the standards that would be relevant are domestic law and human rights law. And I think the challenge that we have in these kinds of, you know, cross-border, non-international armed conflicts is precisely to see how those kinds of standards would apply in the context of an external military operation. What meaning do those standards have? And I think that you can find meaningful equivalence to those standards, but it's not something that can be done in a kind of automatic way. You know, the standards aren't available off the peg. They involve a kind of judgment, a determination of what these things could mean. I don't really want to talk about the technical question of the, you know, how human rights law applies extraterritorially, because that's very technical. But I take it for granted that, at least in some respects, in some cases, human rights law does bind the actions of a state outside its own territory. But in addition to that, I think you know, the sort of normative principles associated with human rights, leaving aside the particular treaty regimes, you know, must be relevant. That is to say, what are the rights that any individual has just by virtue of his human dignity against being seized or being killed by a state that has the effective power to do so? You know, those standards remain relevant. And it seems to me those are what we have to think about in this case. You know, leaving aside any supposed blanket authorization based on the notion of armed conflict, you have to construct some sort of equation where, on the one hand, the right to life of the suspected terrorist is balanced against the threat that they pose. And I think that there, you know, this could arguably allow killings in some cases. I don't think it's always going to forbid them under human rights standards. Just as I said, human rights law allows the use of force in the context of a domestic insurrection. So it would allow the use of force by forces overseas, either against immediate threats to their security, or you could perhaps try and argue that there's a kind of global insurrection that Al-Qaeda is mounting that would justify the use of force against them. A long-term campaign of violence rather than a particular imminent threat to a particular individual, but that this human rights law might allow this because there's against the background of not of a kind of neat rule of law, but against the background of disorder. These people are located in a region where they can't be detained, so it may be that killing them is the only way to stop the threat that they represent. You know, and as I mentioned before, the European Convention on Human Rights does include this notion of the use of force to put down an insurrection is not a violation of the right to life. So I think that's the, you know, the area that you need to be thinking about in terms of assessing targeted killings. But you know, I think this would leave in place an obligation to arrest whenever possible, rather than to use lethal force. And of course, there would always be restrictions in terms of the potential harm to other innocent lives that would be involved. And this view that I'm setting forward actually matches quite closely the arguments that the Israeli Supreme Court used when they considered the issue of targeted killing. Although the Israeli Supreme Court judgment, for those of you who know it, was kind of a little bit unclear as to whether it was appealing to laws of armed conflict or human rights law. But essentially it reached a somewhat similar view to this. And then I think you could make a similar claim with reference to detention. So that is to say that, you know, in the domestic context, as I've said, it's only when you talk about a public emergency that it becomes impossible to ensure the rule of law by simply through a process of prosecution and criminal law. Then you have the right to derogate from human rights rules, and the state can detain without trial in a state of emergency. So, you know, I think you then have to try and develop some sort of international notion of a state of emergency. You know, how could you define the appropriate standards for when it's okay to seize someone and hold them without trial, because that's the only way of preventing a grave threat that they pose to the well-being, the national life of your state. And you can see that this would be a scale which would depend on the situation where you found them. So in the case, again, of, you know, forces that are on the ground in a zone of hostilities, say US forces in Afghanistan, they would have, you know, quite wide scope to detain suspected insurgents, because these insurgents would be posing an immediate threat to their lives. But the further away you get from such a situation, the harder it would be to justify this. So I'll try and conclude with this brief sketch. Where does this all end up in terms of what the US should do? You know, what I'm arguing is that when it comes to saying what rights does the US have, a question which still remains unsettled, which the Obama administration is still grappling with, it doesn't really help you to appeal to, you know, a kind of prefabricated set of answers coming from the notion of armed conflict. Whether or not there's an armed conflict in this context doesn't provide the kinds of standards that some people might like to claim it does. Similarly, I think, you know, it would be nice to claim that the rules of law enforcement operate in all cases, but I think, you know, that also is not a complete answer, because there are areas where people are moving around that do present a threat to the US, whether we're talking about Afghanistan or wherever. So it's a question, I think, of coming up with a new set of standards, a new model which is not going to be easily, there isn't sort of accepted standards by which you can simply adjudicate this. I think what the US needs to do, and is long overdue, is to come up with its own statement of what it regards as the appropriate scope of rules, which I think has to be based not on an appeal to a pre-existing model, but it has to be based, I think, on the statement about how effective it regards the international rule of law as being. In other words, what the US is going to do when it defines the scope of its right to detain or its right to target is effectively to say what it understands the effective rule of law of being at that point. So the wider that it claims the right to target people without, without obviously trying them and convicting them first, you know, the more it's, as it were, shrinking the idea of the international rule of law and expanding the idea of a kind of global disorder where the rule of law has to step back and make some sacrifices. And similarly, the wider scope it claims for the powers to detain people without trial, the more it's saying that there is a global disorder similar to a state of emergency within a country, and it's narrowing the scope of what it regards as the effective rule of law internationally. And I say this to say that, you know, to my view, it's very important that when, you know, because the US is such an influential actor in these situations, the U.S. statements could have a kind of constitutive function, so that the way the U.S. acts and the kinds of justification it offers will actually affect what the rule of law means in the international world today. And it's, you know, it's a complex question. We don't manifestly live in a world where anyone running around the world who poses a threat or who's committed a crime can be dealt with through criminal law. You know, that would be a utopian claim. But neither do we want to admit that we live in a world of such disorder that it's okay, for instance, for agents of state A simply to walk up to the hotel room where a suspected terrorist is holed up and shoot him in the head. You know, so we have to try and find some balance. And what the U.S. does in response to the threat of al-Qaeda, I think, is going to help determine where that balance is. I think that's the right way to look at it. And I hope that those wider consequences are borne in mind by the Obama administration, as well as thinking about the balance of votes in Congress, that it's going to think about those wider consequences when it does finally define the powers that it's going to claim against al-Qaeda. Thank you.